Being a new year, I thought it would be an appropriate time to start on something new. And since there are 12 months in the year and there are 12 books of Minor Prophets, I thought I would try something a little bit different, a little bit challenging for me, because my knowledge of the Minor Prophets is not exactly extreme, and pick a sermon out of a different Minor Prophet each month for 2024. So today, we're not going to go through them necessarily in the order in which they appear, but I am going to start with the first one today. We're going to find a lesson from the book of Hosea. We're going to be looking at the first three chapters of Hosea. So if you'd like to mark your or open your Bibles to there, we will be looking at passages from there quite a bit. Did you ever have someone that you trusted break a significant promise to you? Maybe betray a confidence? Someone you trusted completely who took advantage of that trust and completely betrayed you? Probably. Most of us have at one point or another experienced that. And today we're going to look at a love story gone horribly wrong. It's the story of God's love for his chosen people and their unfaithfulness to him. But it's another story that gives a more concrete example of how God felt. It's the story of Hosea. Now, God said to Hosea that he wanted him to go, and this is the first thing that God says to Hosea. When God first speaks to Hosea, he says, Hosea, I want you to go and find an unfaithful woman to marry. Aren't you glad you weren't an Old Testament prophet? But Hosea obediently goes out, and I don't know how he knew that this particular woman, Gomer, was going to be unfaithful, but maybe she already had a reputation? Could be. It's hardly the first quality that anyone would look for in a wife, but when God says do it, Hosea does it. Good lesson for us. Hopefully God won't ask us to do that particular thing. We're told in chapter 1, verse 3, that his wife Gomer conceived and bore Hosea a son. God told him to name him Jezreel. This is a word that means to scatter. This is the first indication that God is reaching the end of his patience. Jezreel is the name of a city in Israel, and it's a city with a lot of bloodshed involved. Jezreel is the place where Naboth's vineyard was located. And, of course, the King Ahab lived next door to Naboth and really wanted that vineyard and offered to buy it. And Naboth said, how could I possibly sell my family's inheritance? This isn't our land, this is God's land. He's given it to our families and it needs to stay in our families. So Ahab goes home all dejected and his wife Jezebel says, what's wrong with you? And he says, Naboth won't sell me his vineyard. And Jezebel says, what are you, man or mouse? You're king here. I will get it for you. And Jezebel arranges to have Naboth and a few other unsavory men at a feast and put them near each other. And during the feast, the unsavory men are going to accuse Naboth falsely of wrongdoing. And so all of that happens, and they take him out and stone him to death for his wrongdoing. And so Jezebel says, guess what? Naboth's vineyard is up for grabs. So that's one example of the horrific things that have gone on. Another example is Jehu, one of the best of the bad kings of Israel. They never had a good king. But Jehu came along and destroyed all the Baal worship in Israel. And then he went ahead and destroyed all of the royal family in Jezreel, dozens of people from the royal family. And although all of this seemed like it was things that he was supposed to do, the Bible bears record that Jehu, for all that he went that far and got rid of the Baal worship, he never got rid of those idols that we talked about in our Bible class this morning that Jeroboam had set up at the northern and southern edges of the northern kingdom of Israel. And they were still there. So Israel, like I say, has a history of idol worship from its inception right up until the end of its history. Jezreel, scattered. We're then told that Hosea's wife Gomer has another child. Unlike the narration of the first birth where it says that she bore him a child, this time it just says she bore a child. It doesn't say who she bore it to. The paternity of this question appears, of this baby, appears to be in question. Anyway, God tells Hosea to call this baby girl Lo Ruhama. Aren't you glad you're not the child of an Old Testament prophet? Lo Ruhama, time for dinner. Lo Ruhama means no mercy or not loved. Also probably a bit of an eye-opener or a bit of a hint into the paternity or lack thereof of this baby. Not loved. And God told Hosea to name this baby that, saying, I will no more have mercy on the house of Israel to forgive them at all. God was done with them. He goes on to say that he will save Judah this time, but not Israel. Then it happened again. She conceived and bore a son. Again, it does not say bore him a son, just bore a son. God told Hosea to name this one Lo-Ami, which means not my people. Definitely a child of questionable paternity if the child is called not mine. But this wasn't about the paternity of Lo-Ami. This was about the paternity of the kingdom of Israel, the kingdom of whom God was supposed to be their king. And God says, this child of questionable parentage is like you, the kingdom of Israel, a kingdom of questionable parentage, because you are supposed to belong to me. But look at you. Look at you for centuries now, worshiping these golden calves and goodness knows what else. You are not my people. God had been dealing with them for a long time, a very long time. His own people, whom he had loved, led, protected, provided for, disciplined when they went wrong, forgave when they came back, his own people had finally sunk to the point where God was washing his hands of them. Not my people was the picture of the nation of Israel, having completely forsaken the God who had loved them beyond measure and had traded it all in for Baal worship. Imagine the heartbreak of having to disown your own child. But that's what's happening here. God is disowning the kingdom of Israel. And yet, even here, God holds out a message of hope for this people from whom he's currently distancing himself. Verse 10 of Hosea 1, yet the number of the children of Israel shall be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And watch this. In the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, it shall be said to them, children of the living God. And the children of Judah and the children of Israel shall be gathered together, and they shall appoint for themselves one head. And they shall go up from the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel. Say to your brothers, you are my people, and to your sisters, you have received mercy. Is that not beautiful? Right in the very same breath where God is distancing himself from his people, disowning them, saying, you are not my people, he says, but you know what? There's going to be a time. There's going to be a time of reunification, not only with me, but with each other, with Judah and Israel together. And there'll be one nation with one king. And it's going to be beautiful. In the place where it was said to them, you are not my people. Basically, right now, God is saying to them, you are not my people. And God is also saying, this is also going to be the place where at some future date, you are going to come back to me. Most of chapter 2 is as if God were taking his people to court. Plead with your mother, plead, it says in chapter 2, verse 2. But it has more of a connotation of pleading a case in court than, or even accusation than just begging with someone, as we often think of the term plead. And even though God has ample evidence to convict his people, just as Hosea has ample evidence to convict his wife, even at this 11th hour, he still pleads with them for faithfulness. Whether it's Hosea pleading with his wife for faithfulness or God pleading with his children, it's all the same thing. As always, God's threats for unfaithfulness are as severe as his promises for faithfulness are extreme. If she refuses, he threatens here in chapter 2 to make her like a dry wilderness, killing her with thirst, verse 3. Make her way precarious and treacherous and totally blockaded, verse 6. Unable to pursue her lovers who she thinks has given her such generous gifts in return for her favors. Verse 7. It's likely that all three of these things literally happened when Samaria was besieged and the northern kingdom destroyed, which happened not too long after this was written. This thing where she thinks that her lovers have given her such generous gifts, the people of Israel at that time, and this is borne out in various places in Hosea, really truly believed that serving Baal was the way to accumulate wealth, the way to ensure that the land would be fertile, a way to ensure that the people would be fertile and would be able to reproduce, and that the kingdom would be great if only they faithfully served Baal. That's how far they had gone from God, how deluded they were, that they were convinced that the richness of their country was because they were faithfully serving Baal. But then God forecasts that then she shall say, this is halfway through verse 7 of chapter 2, then she shall say, I will go and return to my first husband, for it was better for me then than now. And she did not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the wine and the oil, and who lavished on her silver and gold, which they used for Baal. And why did she decide to return to her first husband? Was it out of some great desire for forgiveness and renewed relationship? No, it was, I was better off than now. Let me do the math. things have gone badly here, even though I was serving Baal, so maybe I got that wrong. So maybe if I go back and serve God and do all the things that I'm supposed to do, maybe he'll, you know, give me good stuff and I'll have a better life. You know, it's almost like the original prosperity gospel. You know, I better serve this God this way because that's going to be my way to riches. So she says, I will go and return to my husband because it was better for me then than now. And she did not know that it was I who gave her all this stuff that she used for Baal. But by this time, it was going to be too late. And it's not like Israel wasn't warned. In addition to the countless prophets that God sent to Israel through the centuries, right from the creation of the nation of Israel, God had warned them. The last thing before the Israelites crossed into the promised land after the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness after Egypt, God gathered the people between two mountains, Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. And from Mount Ebal were read all the curses that would happen to the people of Israel if they were not faithful to God. And from Mount Gerizim were read all the blessings that would be the people's if they were faithful to God. The people knew this, or should have known this, right from the inception of their country, centuries before it even split into the northern and southern kingdoms. And what we see here in Hosea 2:9 and the verses following that are just a few of those curses that were read in Deuteronomy from Mount Ebal. Therefore, I will take back my grain in its time and my wine in its season, and I will take away my wool and my flax, which were to cover her nakedness. You see how much is being taken away? Food, wine, wool, flax. Now I will uncover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers, and no one shall rescue her out of my hand. And I will put an end to all her mirth, her feasts, her new moons, her Sabbaths, and all her appointed feasts. And I will lay waste her vines and her fig trees, of which she said, these are my wages, which my lovers have given me. Again, the people fought that their prosperity was because they were faithfully serving Baal. I will make them a forest, and the beasts of the field shall devour them. And I will punish her for the feast days of the Baals, when she offered offerings, when she burned offerings to them, and adorned herself with her ring and jewelry, and went after her lovers, and forgot me, declares the Lord. You know what God's doing here? You know what he's actually threatening to withhold from her? Well, for one thing, God is removing from his people what a husband is supposed to provide for his wife. Exodus 21:10 says, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, or her marital rights. And he's not even talking specifically about a wife here. He's talking about a woman who's been taken captive and basically made his slave. And if he ends up interested in someone else, he still is not supposed to diminish these things even for that woman. And God is saying, I am going to be taking this away from you. God is saying, you are not my people. I am disowning you, and I will no longer be acting as a husband would act towards his wife. I'm going to take away your food. I'm going to take away your drink. I'm going to take away materials that you can use to make clothing. I'm even going to take away the clothing itself. And in a little while, we'll find out about the marital rights part as well. God is also removing what a God is supposed to provide to enable for his people to worship him by removing their ability to worship Baal. The same thing as the food and the drink, everything that they would have used to sacrifice to Baal, he's going to take away. So God is no longer going to respond to Israel as a husband or as a God. New moons, Sabbaths, all feasts that God had appointed had morphed into Baal feasts. They had attributed to Baal the fertility of the land. Now God would show them where that fertility actually came from. But God isn't content to leave things like that. We're going to jump ahead briefly to chapter 3 now, and then we'll come back and finish 2. Chapter 3, the Lord said to me, "Go show love to your wife again, though she is loved by another man and is an adulteress. Love her as the Lord loves the Israelites, though they turn to other gods and love the sacred raisin cakes." So, says Hosea, I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and about a homer and a lethek of barley. Then I told her, "You are to live with me many days. You must not be a prostitute or be intimate with any man, and I will behave the same way towards you. For the Israelites will live many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred stones, without ephod or household gods. Afterward, the Israelites will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. They will come trembling to the Lord and to his blessings in the last days." Regardless of her unfaithfulness, Hosea is told to take her back. So he pays for his own wife. And understand, in Bible times, he'd already paid for her because there was a bride price that was always paid when you wanted to marry a woman. Okay, so regardless of the fact the bride price had already been paid previously, he has to go now and buy Gomer back, twice paid for now. But she isn't being brought back in a no questions asked, we'll just pretend the past never happened. No, that's not what happens. Hosea has the right to lay out the terms, and those were that she was not to be intimate with any man, even him, and that in return he would also refrain from intimacy. This picture is that last husbandly duty that, remember I said from Exodus he was supposed to make sure he always provided his wife with food, drink, and marital rights. And we saw the food and the drink being taken away. Now we're seeing the marital rights, the intimacy, being taken away for a time. This is indicative of Israel's coming inability to worship any god, even if they wanted to. This privation is used by God to demonstrate the vacuum that they are going to feel when they can no longer worship Baal and they can no longer worship God. Many days, God says, without king or prince, sacrifice or sacred stones, ephod or household gods. But then God foretells of their repentance, their return to him, and receiving of his blessing. Okay, so let's go back to the end of chapter 2 now and finish this off. Back in chapter 2, verses 14 and 15, we see a parallel turn where this incredibly loving God reveals that there is still a reason to hope, regardless of how final Israel's future seems at this point. And they will very shortly thereafter be overthrown as a nation, never again to be a nation. But God is going to court her again. He says that he will allure her, lead her into the wilderness, and speak tenderly to her. When God first created the nation of Israel, guess what happened? As soon as he brought them out of Egypt, he led them into the wilderness, didn't he? And for 40 years, he prepared this people for nationhood. Now, as was pointed out in class this morning, also in the wilderness was the time when Aaron set up the golden calf, just like Jeroboam set up the golden calves in the northern and southern ends of the kingdom that started the downfall. But this is a different leading them to the wilderness to bring them into a relationship with God all over again. Will allure her, lead her into the wilderness, speak tenderly to her. Because although God had finally reached the breaking point, the kingdom was permanently going to be done away with, but God would never leave his people without hope. And look at the absolutely beautiful response that this would engender. Chapter 2, verses 16 and 17, they will engage in a loving relationship to a loving father rather than selecting a master to obey. In that day, it says in 16 and 17, in that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband. You will no longer call me my master. I will remove the names of the Baals from her lips. No longer will their names be invoked. Now, in some of your translations, you may see, instead of saying, you will no longer call me my master, some of your translations may say, you will no longer call me my Baal. Because the word Baal meant master. And so when they said, my Baal, they were saying, my master. And God is saying, that's no longer the kind of relationship that you are going to have with a deity. It's not going to be a master-servant relationship. You are going to come back to the relationship that you were always intended to have with your deity. You are going to call me my husband. That speaks of so much more than, if I serve in this way, I can expect this kind of reward. No, this is about a relationship. Gone would be the day when they would serve God for what they could get, but for the relationship that they could enjoy with him. Verse 18, in that day I will make a covenant with them, a covenant for them with the beasts of the field, the birds in the sky, and the creatures that move along the ground. Bow and sword and battle I will abolish from the land so that all may lie down in safety. This is a picture of the perfect peace that would follow. That perfect peace that was originally intended in creation. You know, you take a look at Garden of Eden, at Adam calling the animals and figuring out what he was going to name them, that peace that was lost. But that peace that is also referenced in passages like the messianic promise in Isaiah 11, where it says, the wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the young goat, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. Again, that picture of the fact that even creation has suffered from the sins of man. Paul says that too in Romans chapter 8. Verse 19, for the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs together until now. Isn't that interesting? Creation has even suffered from the sins of man. And that won't be made right until the end of time. So this is the picture that God is painting of how beautiful things are going to be when his children come back to him. But not only a picture of peace with creation, but a picture of peace with people. Because he also says, bow and sword and battle I will abolish from the land. Bow is the, you know, the bow and arrow, the weapons that they had at the time. And God says, that's going away because you're not going to need them anymore. Bow and battle. And what was the other one? Sword. Bow and sword and battle I will abolish from the land. A picture of perfect peace. And God would respond in love. Listen to this. I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you in righteousness and justice, in love and compassion. I will betroth you in faithfulness, and you will acknowledge the Lord. In that day I will respond, declares the Lord. I will respond to the skies, and they will respond to the earth, and the earth will respond to the grain, the new wine, and the olive oil, and they will respond to Jezreel. That word respond, coming over and over, after God's people respond to him, he will in turn respond in ways far beyond what he's asking them to do. And then he says in verse 23, I will plant her for myself in the land. I will show my love to the one I called not my loved. I will say to those called not my people, you are my people. And they will say, you are my God. Now, it's interesting. The word Jezreel means scatter. And God was painting a picture of scattering. But at the end of it all, he says, I will plant her for myself in the land. And do you know how a farmer in Bible times planted seed? Think about the parable of the sower. A sower went out and scattered seed, right? And some of it fell on the path, and some of it fell on rocky ground. You know the story. Scatter. Scatter was also a word for planting. So when God referenced the name Jezreel, it was both a good and a bad thing. The Jezreel scattering as punishment would be undone in the Jezreel planting that he talks about here in verse 23 of chapter 2. I will plant her for myself in the land. Is that not beautiful? She is going to grow again in the land. God's plan from before the world was created was to bring the entire world to himself. In Romans 9, Paul talks about the failure of the Jews to believe. Just as the northern kingdom had previously failed in Hosea here, by New Testament times, both kingdoms had failed, the kingdom of Judah as well as the kingdom of Israel, and had been taken out. And although the southern kingdom, Judah, was allowed to return and finally abandoned idol worship, they still refused to believe in Jesus. And Paul talks in Romans 9 about his heartbreak in seeing his own countrymen going down that same path of destruction, unwilling to believe in Jesus. Because now in Jesus, not only are the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom both united in their acceptance of God, of Jesus, if they're willing to do so, but now even the Gentiles are brought in so that the whole of God's creation has that chance to be children of God. Paul says in chapter 9, after referencing the objects of God's mercy, he starts in 24 saying, even us, whom he also called, not only from the Jews, but also from the Gentiles. As he says in Hosea, I will call them my people who are not my people, and I will call her my loved one who is not my loved one. And it will happen in that very place where it was said to them, you are not my people, they will be called sons of the living God. God has made it possible for not only those who were originally his chosen people, but Gentiles, you and me, to be his people. It is not only their sins for which Jesus' blood would atone, but for ours as well. I've seen it shared a few times recently on Facebook. No matter how far you've strayed from God, the journey back is only a step. And that's what God was asking from his people. That's what Hosea was asking of Gomer. All you have to do is take that first step in the right direction. And the response would be there from the loving husband. Israel made huge mistakes. Gomer made huge mistakes. Everybody in the Bible, except for Jesus, made huge mistakes. We're not always told about them, but the Bible tells us about many of them. Why? To let us know about the great forgiveness of an even greater God, regardless of how far away we have wandered from him. Our closing hymn is 358. One of the verses of this song says, "All of my longings, all my dreams, Jesus is Lord of all. All of my failures, his power redeems. Jesus is Lord of all." There is nothing that you have done that can't be forgiven. There is nothing that you have done that would make God say, "You are not my people, period, end of story, sorry about your luck." We need to internalize that message for ourselves, and we need to make that our motivation to draw closer and closer to Jesus. And we also especially need to share this message with people we come in contact with every day. There are so many of them that believe that they are so bad that God can't possibly forgive them. This is a message of hope that we need to not only internalize for ourselves, but to share with a lost and dying world. Because as Hector read for us this morning, once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Let's stand and sing.